You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things.
So let me just do a quick start.
Are you doing visual too? You do the visual?
Yeah. Okay. Oh yeah.
Make sure you get the jowls and everything there.
Yeah. Well, we all have them. You know, it's
God bless you.
Gravity is not kind.
Yeah, my facial surgeon fucked up. What happened? I want my money back.
All right. So, hello everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have what a pleasure it is to be speaking to the legendary Peter Tilden. The legendary Peter Tilden.
If you know what parts of America or the world I'm legendary, please email me and find that.
I'm telling you.
Certain parts of Jersey?
I'm telling you, and this is no bull, right? When I told somebody here, and here, by the way, is Wyoming, just so anybody knows, in a small town in Wyoming, when I told somebody, I was like, who's coming on next? I said, oh, well, next week I'm going to do a podcast with Peter Tilden. And he goes, Peter Tilden, the radio guy? What's he doing now? And I said, oh, he's doing a podcast with Jason, with Jason Alexander. And he goes, is that the Seinfeld guy on Seinfeld? So he knew Peter Tilden. He did not know Jason Alexander. So,
which, by the way, is unsettling in some way. And I wonder if he moved to Miami because of my radio show, just to get away from my radio show. Well, that's very sweet.
Could be. So, so and for anybody who doesn't know you as legendary. You know, it's interesting. It's like anybody else that I look up, there's always a Wikipedia page. You don't have a Wikipedia page? What's the deal?
First of all, I don't know. My people, it sounds like I got to employ a lot of people. But when I started doing this podcast, which I did kicking and screaming, I really didn't want to do a podcast.
Oh, yeah. We're going to definitely talk
because
about
when
that
you tell people to do a podcast, the next thing you hear is my grandson does a podcast. My mechanic does a podcast. My baby.
As far as I can tell, every male over 30 in the United States of America has a podcast.
I want to get this right, the number right, but the social media person that I work with actually emailed me the other day the number of podcasts that launched in April. I may look it up. You can edit if I take a second to look it up.
Yeah.
But the number made me laugh out loud because it's down from last year, but it's still like 36,842 in April. In April.
Exactly.
Like, so while we're talking, I always wanted to have on our podcast, I said to Jason, I would like a counter behind it. Just it's whirring like a fan, like whirring as far as people launching podcasts. But I don't remember. There you go. Good short-term memory. Why did I bring that?
You didn't want to do a podcast. Then you said, everybody does a podcast. And it's like, you know, I said every male in the United States.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, because it's just like when I used to do radio, everybody thinks they can do Howard Stern. And nobody realized that Howard Stern, when he talked about he did a sitcom. It was a cast of characters that you knew.
Yes.
His boss was everybody's boss, who's you're downtrodden and beholden to the boss who's always dumber than you.
Right.
And then you have morons working with you.
Right.
And then you have the smarter woman working with you who keeps you in line. And then you have on and on and on. So it was really he worked really hard to build that thing. But then everybody went on radio and tried to imitate it and talk about themselves, thinking just talking about yourself was the way to do it and not realizing how smart Howard was, how hard he worked. And what a good storyteller he was, you know, and how he evolved.
How did you? Okay, so you've done radio. You're no longer doing radio.
Long time.
Radio for 30 years, 30 years plus. So how did it start?
I mean, radio.
Yeah. Did you like? Well, you know. Well, back
David,
up.
David, everything.
Did
with
you
me
want
including...
to go into showbiz? Did you want like? Well, what's the deal?
No.
Where'd that come from? And by the way, I should say to everybody first. Peter and I. Well, happily, we're back in touch. Peter's one of the people in my life who I consider just a friend forever. And every time we get together, which we did recently with a family, and it just was like we hadn't been apart for a minute. So,
well, and I should say to people who listen regularly to your podcast that David was one of the more influential.
People who listen regularly.
No, I mean, people who find this and listen to it should know that you were such a key, and people say this, but there's not a lot of time that goes by where I don't think about you often, because the big way you impacted my life, the big lessons you taught me, the big lessons we taught each other navigating the private school you worked for, which was not unlike any other school ever, because half of the people there didn't pay. It was by need. So you would watch kids graduate who would have never gotten a chance.
That's right.
To go to a decent school and get into a Stanford or wherever. Yeah. And it was every graduation from the first one, which I think had 20 kids, maybe.
Which yours? No, that was 12 kids.
12 kids, which my son was part of. Yeah. To my younger son's graduation, where they had 60 kids, maybe.
Probably.
I learned so much from David and from that environment. It was a magical number of years for me and evolution for me.
And so here you are, and I ask you to go to work. So, hey, wait, by the way, is this like work for you? I mean, you're sitting behind.
No, I talk for, you can't like, shut what? Me. My problem is, and I always want to know if I'm talking too much. The other thing I always ask people is, have I changed during COVID? Because I'm sure I have in some way. And have I changed because I've gotten older, because I get crankier? Because when you're, I don't know if anybody else suffers this, but I go to the supermarket still on Sunday morning at 7, because that was a COVID practice to avoid people. And when I go out, I somehow need to get back home right away for no reason. There's no rational reason, but it's ingrained. I used to be very social, and I'm not as much.
Yeah.
And by the way, I told you beforehand, I don't want to get political, and we don't on our podcast. We try and get informational. But the one political thing I will tell you is that when I launched the podcast, we had sold it to iHeart. And I went to Atlanta, and this was in the height of COVID, and traveling was really tough. And I'm in the airport in Atlanta. Not everybody had the mask memo, or didn't want to do it, or was against it. And the person boarding the plane in front of me is coughing and sneezing. And he's got his hand around his wife, and I'll tell you how I knew it was his wife, and turns and coughs. And I can tell the story that I got COVID from RF Kennedy Jr. That was who was boarding the plane in front of me. So I'm convinced. That's who gave me COVID in Atlanta.
I think actually everyone got COVID from RFK.
From RFK Jr. There you go. So there you go.
Zero.
Whether you're an anti-vaxxer or not, I don't care. Knock yourself out. It's just that I know that I got my COVID from RFK Jr. because he was coughing and wheezing. So there you go.
So
you asked about getting into radio.
Yeah.
I never thought about show business. I grew up with immigrant parents who had to flee Europe. And lose everything and start. And I grew up in a row home in Philly. So I knew no one in show business, had no modeling, anybody in show business. And don't remember being funny as a kid or talkative as a kid. As a matter of fact, I remember kind of doom and gloom, because when you grow up with parents who had to flee and lost everything,
yes,
there are two types of parents that come out of that, I found. One type is joyous and says, I got another chance at this. And then the other, which I totally understand, which is doom and gloom. Don't get close to anything because it's going to go away.
Right.
Don't get close. That was the cloud that was over my house.
That was home.
And that was home. So I do know I fled that early and found mentors at college and mentors at different places, but never knew what I wanted to do, and got jobs in a lot of different fields, selling industrial strapping.
Not a lot.
So I worked a lot of different stuff. And then I ended up working at a radio station in sales. Not having any idea that would become anything. And then at some point, I guess I started producing some stuff and doing commercials for people, and they liked it, and somebody heard about me and offered me to come out to California to do Morning Drive, which was unheard. I had no experience. And I came out and did Morning Drive, lasted for a year, because my immediate boss hated me because he didn't hire me. Corporate hired me. And I came out. It was a tough year. I did warm up for a TV show and got fired during the warm-up by the vice president of Universal Studios. That's how, it wasn't that I was bad, it was that I'd never been to a show taping before and didn't know what I was doing. So they would say, we're ready, and I'd go, hold on a second. I had no idea. And he thought it was so funny that the writers of Major Dad, who the show was, invited me back to the writer's room that night hired me and got me an agent. So now I'm writing for a TV show. I didn't even know how to get to Universal Studios. I'm doing Morning Drive. I get fired from doing that show, but KABC, a talk station, hires me. So now I'm doing talk radio, writing for television, and I have no idea what I'm doing on either front. I'm faking it.
So pretty amazing. This is really, you sort of fell into it. This was not, I grew up wanting to be in showbiz and I landed. And
now... Well, in addition to that, you know, I left because I interviewed Larry. I know Larry, and Larry went to New Rights. As a matter of fact, I did the fundraiser for New Rights with Larry David. I interviewed Larry for that point. No, I never wanted to do it, never thought I could do it. And when I told my mother, my father passed away, that I'm going to be on radio, her first response was, and that Larry laughed that night because the first thing I said to him, which I knew would set him off, is, so I'm guessing you have supportive parents. And he just started laughing. And I had a similar situation where I said to my mother, I'm going to be on radio. She said, do you think you're smart enough? And when I told her I was going to be on TV, she said, do you think you're good looking enough? So what's the opposite of supportive parents? So the whole thing, David, even this is an accident.
Okay.
I've been really lucky. Look, I've gotten to work with some of the funniest people that live, from Joan Rivers, who was like my mom, to Larry Bresner, who you know, who ran one of the biggest comedy agencies, who was, I think that's the funniest person.
One of the funniest people we ever knew. Absolutely.
And Larry, I mean, in that agency was Robin Williams and Billy Crystal. And it's amazing the people that we've been exposed to that are really funny people. So I'm a piker. I can kind of fake it, but I don't think I'm that funny.
Yeah.
I don't like telling jokes, but this is one of my favorite jokes in the last 5 years, but it involves cursing. It's got one curse.
Whatever.
May I tell it? Because I think your audience is probably erudite, and they will like the joke.
Yeah, I'm not sure they're erudite, but you know.
Well, but it's my favorite joke in the last 5 years.
Turn it off.
Ready? Ready?
Go ahead.
So a guy is interviewing a candidate for a major job, high-power job, important job. And it goes on for 3 days, and there are hardly any bathroom breaks, and the room is hot. They don't have food. I mean, they really make it unpleasant for this person, so they can see, even under duress, how this person responds. And it's similar to a friend of mine who actually interviewed for the Dodgers. His interview was kind of like this, and it went on for 3 days. Intense, tough, thoughtful questions, insightful questions. And at the end of the 3 days, the interview is wrapping up and says to the candidate, I shouldn't say this. It's wrong to say this, but I'm so impressed with the 3 days. And you were so stellar and so insightful, and you took time to think through the questions I was asking you. Your answers were impressive. Your demeanor was impressive. I really got to tell you, and again, I shouldn't do this, that you were something else. So I'm just letting you know that before we end. But I always end with the same question. For every candidate, would you mind if I ask you the question? And the guy says, no. He said, so we've talked about your good points. What do you think your biggest negative is? And the guy thinks for a minute and says, probably that I'm too brutally honest. And the guy laughs and says, I don't see that as a negative. And the guy goes, I don't give a fuck what you see as a negative. Thank you. Right? And you and anybody who's interviewed people get it's just you go, oh my God.
You know, I realized this morning I was scared. I was scared to be doing this because I think you're one of the best interviewers I've ever heard. I interview. So like you're one of the best conversationalists, especially, you know, on the air. You get people to talk about stuff. It's just really I walking into this, I was like, suddenly realized, like, what the fuck am I doing?
You know, it's funny you say that because I had been told that I'm a good interviewer. And if people saw, like when I was at KBC, for instance, and this is before you could Google stuff, and I would come in and Ken Minyard, who was a morning guy for years there, would laugh at me every day because I brought in a pile of this and notes and stuff. I'm bad at history. I'm bad at math. I'm bad at so much stuff. I always over-prepare to the point that it's scary. I make myself nuts. And I try and find a couple oh wows that nobody, if I'm doing a story, it's how do I find the oh wow that nobody else has thought of, nobody else has looked at, nobody else has asked that question, or how do you do it so that you're really connected and present? So It's in your head, so you don't have to look at the stuff and you can go where you need to go. But there's an art to interviewing. But you also, people also say to me, how did you do it successfully for that long? And I said, I interview the AAA guy. I interview the waitress. I love finding, traveling through cultural time and space by listening to other people and by asking questions and finding out their insight. And more. And people love to tell you stuff. They want to be heard. So what an opportunity. It's a really magical opportunity. Look, I look forward to this because as well as I know you, I didn't know where we were going to go. And it's fun being able to navigate and find out maybe stuff, even with our relationship being this long, something I didn't know, or an opportunity to go somewhere, you know?
Totally. But
thanks for the compliment.
To me, that's the best thing about doing this. You know, it started as just like some idea because I ran out of classrooms, right? You know, and I really missed it. Well, you know, I got the technology. But the exploration of, and it goes, when it's an interview, you know, question, answer, and some people really want that, expect that, want that. It's, you know, it's either good or it's bad because the person's interesting or not, or, you know, I care about it or I don't. And, but when it's a conversation, it's fabulous.
Well, and the reason that when it goes from an interview to a conversation, is like I said, I over-prepare. I make myself sick every time. I've got four coming up with Jason Alexander, and I will make myself sick trying to figure out the flow of it and what I can ask and how to entertain. But then once I'm there, I have that all in my head. And then you just look at, if you really, everybody has a hard time, I think, being 100% present. It's really hard. Yeah. You know, my grandmother used to say, the older living in the past, the younger living in the future, nobody's living in the present. If you can be looking at somebody like you and say, I'm 100% here and let's see where this, I got it in my head. I know what we're doing. Yeah. Let's just now connect. And you did that with students and parents. When you're like a doctor in the sense that a doctor has to hear what the patient is saying, but there's emotionality tied to it. There's misinformation tied to it. There's a lot tied to it. So they got to cut through that and say, what's the patient really telling me?
Mm-hmm.
What am I seeing in their eyes? What am I feeling that they're feeling? Because I'm sure, David, knowing you, you've many times said to a parent, hold on, stop for a minute. Why you seem scared right now, or you seem angry right now, and it's butting up against what you're telling me. Forget that. We'll address that. Because I know you.
Yeah.
You have to kind of cut through and say, what's the real issue here?
Mm-hmm.
Because with schools, there's always my kid's not living up to my expectation. My kid is unhappy. My kid is being bullied. There's all kinds of stuff that they don't tell you that's mired in that conversation. And you got to be a really, not good listener, but a good listener and try and discern what's really going on. And I'm sure you miss that.
Oh, it's the best thing. It's the best.
You're a detective.
It's the best. It is. It is, especially with kids. And, you know, it always felt like such an honor to me. It's really because like these people are trusting me with their kid.
Well, like, can I tell the story? So my oldest son, I don't think he'll mind me telling this. This is the part of David that has stayed with me forever. My son was an addict, and I'm divorced. My wife ships him out and says, could you please take him? And it wasn't that I didn't want to have him. There were other issues, piled on issues. So of course I would take him. And I had a minute and a half to get him into a private school. And your private school at that point was three rooms at the Girls and Boys Club in Santa Monica. And I was dodging balls being thrown at my head and foosball.
Foosball.
And I go in and I say to my son, do not tell David. We are up against it. Do not tell David what you've been doing, what you've been caught doing. We need this. And of course, he goes in the room, they close the door, and he tells David everything.
The last thing he wanted was to go to school.
Because he wanted to go back to Philadelphia and see his friends and continue doing what he's doing. And David opened the door and looked at me. And I'm sitting there ready to go because I'm panicked. I don't know what to do. And David said, I think we need him as much as he needs us. So that was the beginning of it. And then the big lesson, and this seems trivial, is not long after that, David said to me, we were talking, and David said, you know, they came to me this morning and said, can they order pizza?
Oh, no, they didn't. They didn't ask in advance.
Oh, they didn't ask. They just ordered pizza. And the guy shows up. Okay,
like,
all right.
Like, no, you got the wrong place. And this little kid comes up and says, oh, no, that's mine. I was like, what? You ordered pizza.
So David goes ballistic and then tells me later, you know something? I was wrong. I thought to myself, if they could get it together and somebody could collect the money, somebody could order the pizza and they could arrange to get it so it didn't disrupt anything. Why am I doing that? And I realized from that I was a no dad, that my default position was no, because of parents who were scared of where they came from. And that seemingly insignificant thing that I learned from David changed my behavior for the next to now. It was that huge. Yeah. Thinking about, why am I saying no?
Yeah.
So that's a big thing. It's a big lesson.
Yeah. I get it. So, wait, I want to make sure.
This is why I didn't say no to this.
Yeah. But you wish you had.
No, not at all. I will, but not yet. It's coming.
Okay, so you and Jason Alexander.
You think this is what the guy who invented Zoom was thinking about?
Yeah. No. I think what he was thinking about is exactly what's happening. Cha-ching.
Bill Zoom. Billy Zoom. Yeah. Pretty amazing.
It is kind of amazing. It is
truly amazing.
It is, like, you know, and especially for meetings. It's, you know, for broadcasting, maybe not. There's lots of
how about grandparents seeing their kid, being able to connect with their kids. Everybody's isolated now. And I know
unbelievable
does not replace in person, because the nuances are subtly, whatever, the emotion still, is touching. But however,
oh my God.
And by the way, where I record my show at a studio in Van Nuys that Howie Mandel owns, which is fascinating because one building that he owns does AI. Okay. But the other one has this virtual reality box, like a 3D hologram. And it's a box that's about 5 feet wide by about 8 feet high. Tiffany Haddish did a bat mitzvah in that box. She was home. You could see the people, talk to them, interact. And if I go up to nose to nose, it looks like the person's standing there in front of you. It's the most impressive thing. And they're trying to get the cost down. So a desktop version
would
be under $1,000 and then eventually $800, $600. And that way, a parent, a grandparent, whatever, it feels must leap years ahead of this. Even.
Does it look like when you're seeing the person, does it look like you're 3D? Like if you sort of move
3D.
This way, you
sort of no, the no, 100% 3D, 3D.
Wow.
Christie's or Julian's, one of the auction houses uses it. And I mean, they're showing you the item. They're turning it over. It's in front of your face. It's an inch from your face. You're looking at the inside and you say, now, can you turn it that way? They can see you. They can answer questions. It's like it's the closest thing to having the person there.
Wow.
It's amazing. Wow. Stunning. Yeah.
What's it
called?
If
anybody's in, it's called Proto 3D.
Proto
3D. I caution you, though, when you go to their website and see it, it looks great, but it doesn't look as good as it does in person. You can't replicate what that feeling is. They have a video, if you go to their site, and I have nothing to do with this. I don't make a dollar. That's another wonderful thing about my life. I've never figured out how to turn anything into any kind of monetary gain. But they actually...
Meanwhile, you got some nice guitars back there.
given that one... But if you want to name drop, this one is Brad Paisley's show guitar. And that guitar above it is because I found a guitar I loved, told Brad Paisley about it, and he ended up buying the guitar. So he got me that when he found out one of my birthdays that I was the biggest Paul McCartney fan.
Oh,
and he
my
bought
God.
Me a Beatles, cool. A Beatle bass. Yeah,
very
a bass
cool.
guitar.
That's amazing.
Pretty
That's
amazing.
Why'd we, what, oh, the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about the show. Okay. So. When did you start it? How long has it been going
February,
on?
February. We launched.
Really, really, February, no, really. That poster really, that's no, really. Right behind you there.
We launched February 7th of last year. We're just a year, February, March, April, May. So we're a year and 3 months, a year and four months. Yeah.
And where'd it come from? Like what?
I left radio. And again, I don't want to get political, but the problem with what I was doing on radio after all those years was I didn't want to be on a team. You know, I had, you know this from listening to the show, I had Jack Abramoff on one day, who was right wing, and I had somebody left. I was solution oriented because you don't get answers by being on a team. You know, you want to find out, well, how come?
Yeah.
Immigration, what's the real issue? I've been here through Democratic and Republican administrations. No one's fixing it, and you can. Why are they not? Are we being sold a bill of goods? It became so team oriented that people didn't care anymore. I couldn't have a conversation with anybody because they would be, for, I'll use an example, somebody would call and say, Hillary sold uranium to the Russians. And I go, yeah. And you're angry about it, right? Yeah. It was the wrong thing to do, bad. I go, do you know this? Did anyone know about it? Excuse me? Did anyone know about it? Because you know there was a committee that was also part of that. In and you know why she sold it and what did she get? So I said, sir, you're calling me basically angry about something that if you were in seventh grade right now, you stayed up last night and you wrote the title of the thesis and then you went to sleep.
Right.
You know nothing about it. And you're entitled to be angry about it. You're entitled to feel whatever way you want if you have the info. And I want to learn from you why you're angry about it, but you don't have any info.
Yeah.
And this would be on the right and left. People would call about climate change, but never read an article about climate change. People would call about vaccine and they wouldn't read anything. And I'm not trying to convert anybody. I'm trying to have a conversation that's information-based. So I left because it got so frustrating, David, that I didn't want to convince anybody. Because guess what? I mean, I just saw John Stewart the other night. You talk about graft in Congress. Guess what? It's everybody.
Plenty.
It's every. Oh, there's plenty.
Plenty.
Plenty. Plenty. Yeah. I think John Stewart was cutting out Menendez for stealing. Yeah. He said, why would you have to go out of your comfort zone? You can do it right in Congress. I mean, Dennis Hastert paid a guy, kid, $3 million. And I went, he was a coach and then he was a gym coach and then he was in the Senate. How did he make with the House
that much money?
How did he have $3 million to pay, let alone?
Hey, right. Exactly.
The insider trade, it's insanity. So people didn't want to hear it and do solution.
Right.
They just wanted to be on a team and it got frustrating and sad for me. So I couldn't do it anymore. They were actually, I guess, happy that I left because they're all trying to make their stake because they want the station to be all day right wing or all day left wing.
Right.
The problem with that is, and the secret to why radio is aging out and dying, and the best consultant told me this. Once I tell you my opinion about my big opinion about something, you don't have to listen. You know what's going to be tomorrow. You know what's going to be the next day. You don't have to listen every day. There's no surprise. You know what my opinion is going to be. Well, so why should I tune in all the time to see what your
people? So how do you know? Well, maybe it's past, but you know, like a Rush Limbaugh or you know the guy
Rush Limbaugh when he passed away. Okay, when Rush started, he was an entertainer, and then he was right leaning, and then he became more powerful, and then he bought into it in a bigger way.
Yeah.
But what people don't know is like when Rush was huge, and I knew Rush pretty well. When Rush passed away, at the end of that show, his audience was a third of what it was, and it was 55 plus. His average age, and I think I got this right, I hope I'm not wrong, was like 68. So talk radio is aging out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
First of all, because young people can find it anywhere and they want quicker hits. So you find it a lot of different places, whether it's Rogan or TikTok, whatever. But again, to replicate the same things over and over. Here I was fighting to do creative stuff that's new. If I'm interviewing you, what's the new thing? What's the thing no one knows?
Right.
They're saying you listen to a station that's left-leaning or right-leaning. They're saying the same stuff.
Again.
I was watching, I think, MSNBC yesterday. And they actually said something like, if Trump does, is he going to testify in his trial? And the expert said, I don't think so. It would not benefit. But if he did, and that's now you're getting to sports talk radio.
Yes.
Exactly. So if the pitcher pitched left-handed and he only went three
innings.
This
is news. This is
And if I grew 8 feet. I mean, we're really? Plus, on the right and the left, the pundits, who are they? What's their agenda? Where are they getting paid? Why are they getting paid? How? You listen to that and it just fills your day of guessing and expectation. And the funniest thing was, what's his name? James Carville for this election said, you know, the pundits are out there and they're saying what's going to happen. And you know what's going to happen? Something they didn't expect.
Something
they're going to say, didn't see that coming. So it's kind of a waste of time. So I was fascinated for a lot of years when I could learn from the callers. I would love when callers called me and said, you're wrong. Or you misconstrued that, and being insecure as I have to begin with, I go, explain it to me, and you could change my opinion. I could change a listener's opinion. Not that that was my goal.
All right.
But we could share information. Now, in a world where you can get information so easily, people have much less information because they just buy in these quick snippets it's a shame. That's why I left. And then doing the podcast, I didn't know what I wanted to do. COVID hit.
Then
Then my kids kept saying, do a podcast. And I said, I have no interest in doing podcasts. I had a big audience on radio. No one's, it's like a kid in feet pajamas. Who's going to listen and why would I do it and what's the appeal? And they kept hitting me up for it. And I started researching podcasts. And I thought, you know what? If I can do 36, something.
36,000 in April.
In April. Down. Right. Down.
Down. March was a much better month.
And the successful ones, if you research it, are in the top 10. The seven of the top 10 are usually the same for the last couple bunch of years. And they're the Rogans and Adam Carolla.
Yeah.
And the guy does it in his garage. I'm
blanking. Oh, yeah. The left liberal guy. I forget his name.
Comedian, but he did Obama in his garage and stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They were successful because they started years ago when they were touring comedians and used it as a device to promote their live shows. And they'd go on radio stations in every city, promote their podcast.
Yeah.
And it's a way to reach fan base and not have to spend a lot of money on advertising. You could just then, you know, send out a missive saying, I'm going to be in the Ice House and here. Or so I started doing research in podcasts and then went down the rabbit hole and saw that it was kind of interesting, but wanted to do a brand rather than just a podcast. So I came up with Really No Really, which, by the way, implies that your first answer was BS. No, David, no, really.
Yeah, really, come on.
So and I thought, you know, from having done advertising and branding, it seemed like a funny and a thing. So I called Jason Alexander, who is my best friend, and we've done everything we do, I try and do together so I can see him. Because if not, he'll go off and do a show or whatever. And he loved it. And then I told somebody else about it who got us to iHeart. And we pitched it to the president of iHeart. And he bought it on the spot. And they gave us a two-year contract. And here we go. And then the first year was me trying to figure out how to make it not suck. And how to get Jason to be an interviewer because he didn't interview. And how to balance that out with the two of us. And how much comedy. And what's it going to be about? And interestingly, the first one we did, or not interestingly, if you're already leaving, the first one, the way I sold it was on a Seinfeld joke, which was the bathroom door. Why did they refuse to make the bathroom door go to the floor so they have that little sad viewing area of our feet and pants? Ha ha. And we did it with a bathroom expert. And it was done. And I played it for an intern, a friend, a kid. And it was great because he said, yeah, it's good. It's a little long, you know, for that. And I thought, what he's really saying is there's not enough meat to it. So then I booked an etiquette expert in addition to that to get some insight into why. And the reasons there why they don't make the bathroom door go to the floor. And it's bathroom etiquette and that kind of stuff from her. And it still didn't do it for me. And I'm talking to this kid who's
really... There's an answer
really,
to this? There really is an answer.
There's an answer to why they don't make the door go to the floor. So then I'm trying to give this episode gravitas, and I can't figure it out. And then I reach out to a kid who's helping with some other podcasts in Atlanta, which is where I met RFK and got sick.
Yeah.
And we came up with the bigger part of that episode is not, yes, it's ha-ha, they don't make the bathroom floor go to the floor, but it's the illusion of privacy. If you can see them, they can see you in the crack and all that. And then I took it to the illusion of privacy at home with all the products we have. If somebody was staring at your house all day, you'd go out there and call the police, except that the Ring doorbell is taping your house all day, and you're okay with that.
Right.
And then I went to the illusion of privacy at home on your computer and had an ethical hacker on to finish the episode. And he reminded me that when you give somebody your email, that's half of what they need. Now they have half of your login already.
Yes. Right. Yes.
And now I went, it's not about just the bathroom. It's about a bigger thing. So then we started doing episodes like that. We had the two competitive food eaters, a guy who drank the beverage and a woman who ate hot dogs at Nathan's, the world champions. And what that became was it went to the guy who created reality television with catching bullets in his mouth, in your mouth and stuff like that. It went from the circus used to be the Wild West shows and food eating, et cetera.
Right, the freak show.
Then the circus came to television with reality shows. And now with the internet and Instagram, we're the circus.
Yeah.
So that was great, except it took so much time to do the episodes that way and multiple guests that we couldn't sustain it. So then we ended up kind of reverting back to one topic, but growing it ourselves, getting the ramifications of that topic and trying to get the answer, you know? So.
And do you ever do Does the next episode ever build on the past episode, ever build on the past episode, or no?
It's funny you say that. To drive traffic, I'm not one of those guys who cares about the growth of this thing, because Really Know Really to me was, I wanted to own Really Know Really Tech, Really Know Really Travel, Really Know Really Sports, and have an umbrella for this whole thing that somebody down the road may buy or do or run, and it becomes a bigger thing to me than just the podcast. So my goal was never, let's get this thing to be huge and have millions of people listen. Until I find out how hard it is to get people to listen, because they're busy, they find a new podcast, but they forget to come back. I mean, people are really, and with 36,000 launching a month or whatever that is. So to your point, though, we're doing okay, and we didn't want big celebs on. They drive big traffic, but Jason said, I wouldn't do it if it's that. I love that we're, the guy who's bringing back the woolly mammoth, we interviewed him. The rat expert, the top rat expert in the world as far as these rodent tours in New York, but about rats. And why do we have this problem? Is it us? Is it them? The talking dog, Bunny, the dog who knew, I forget how many hundreds of words and could link them together.
Yeah.
It was a year ago. Where's Bunny now? You know, I'm hoping that she's just not talking, refusing to talk.
Who signs?
The funniest one, and I hope she'll kill me for this, is the woman who was a veterinarian who had the cat that did that. That would press buttons, and her boyfriend at the time, she hated that we include this in the episode. The cat, he taught the cat how to say private time. Give him private time for sex. The cat would walk up and press the buttons. I actually wanted to do a stunt where we taught a dog to go to different buttons, and he had a ton of buttons, but always would go to racist or misogynist. So we bring in new people, like your grandmother, and she'd sit down and say, so what do you, Bunny, what do you think about the grandma? And the dog would go up, you know, race.
Yeah, fat bitch.
That makes me laugh more than anything, that the dog only hits those buttons. Thank you. Good night, drive safely.
So is that still the hope? I mean, is that still the hope of what Really Know Really becomes?
I think that what Really Know Really is becoming is, like I said, the bigger stories that make us go Really Know Really, and staying away from politics, because enough people are doing that and there's enough negative
there.
But that's
the podcast. Are you still?
Well, I'm looking for my second Really Know Really. I'm looking for the Really Know Really Travel right now. We're also looking to do something terrestrial too, Jason, that I don't want to talk about prematurely, but a feature on radio. Yeah. That's nearly no really, and maybe down the road a bigger play. But you know what? If nothing ever happens above and beyond where it is now, and I get to work with Jason for a couple more years, and we get to get really, really interesting people. For instance, I know Howie Mandel for longer than I know Jason, 30 plus years, and we're doing Howie's studio. And I wanted to do Howie because he's a really interesting guy. And Jason was, what's the Really No Really? And I thought, you know what? Howie's on America's Got Talent. You got to criticize people every week, and it seems innocuous. But when you're telling kids they lost, and you're telling people who's coming out there, and they're juggling fire, and they've practiced for 17 years, and they lost. Mm-hmm. And Howie was really, it was a fascinating episode about criticism, and how he felt about it, and how he was criticized for years as being a prop comic, and how Carrot Top came on and talked about that too, about you're making your fortune, but you feel like an idiot in your field, and you feel diminished. And I didn't know, never thought about it, that backstage in America's Got Talent, they got a therapist.
Oh, wow.
Well, and quite, because some people,
sure,
you can imagine, you're criticizing people.
Yeah.
And the audience is laughing, they go on to the next person. That person just put themselves out there in a big way. Ooh. So it turned out to be a really interesting,
that's great,
humanistic side of Howie, and about criticism and us criticizing. I had an expert on about why we're so awful in public to each other now. What is it societally that's changed that much? That people are throwing stuff on stage and yelling at people and treating them awfully. So
I can't help but, you know, going back to what you said way back, you know, maybe it has a positive effect. I can't help but feel like it has to, because that's exactly what.
But I never see it.
People don't hear that.
It's like radio. David is like radio for me. I think if I realized that people heard it or were judging me or were driving in the cars, and at one point I had over a million listeners country, we vacillated from 775 to 1.2 million. Oh my God, I would have not been able to do it, because I looked at it not as show business. I looked at it as a job, work, and a responsibility.
Right.
So I never see the benefit or the negative. And also, I have a son who does music, et cetera, the meanness on the internet. I don't ever look at my social media. I don't want to see what people say because I know that probably if somebody's being mean, they got issues and I don't want to take it personally. I do take criticism because I was criticized my entire life by program directors who every week, every month, hour by hour can see ratings and criticize you. First, when you're younger, you want to push back immediately because it's fight or flight. It's you just immediately go, what do they know, schmuck, idiot. As you get older, I would start thinking, you know, they're in the car driving, doing stuff like a listener. Why are they hearing it that way? And I thought the power is I can choose to ignore it or take 10% of it or 50% of it and use it to benefit rather than just immediately say no. So I always listen to criticism. Sometimes it's really hard, but I always try and go, God, why do they hear it that way? And maybe I am coming across.
Right. And exactly, there's always that, right? Is there a rational kernel here? Or sometimes the criticism is, it just, they say it, maybe the stupidest person in the world, maybe there's more, but they got that right. And it just goes right in and you're right. You're absolutely right.
You had such a huge responsibility to molding kids' lives. You did it for my kids, and my kids love you. I'm here today because I love you, because of
I thought it was so interesting. I was so interesting you want me on your show.
Well, the deal is, David, what you did was it's really hard. Like you said, standing back, as a parent, you stand back all the time and go, I fucked up. You know, my son Robert, who lives here with me, it was so funny, so stupid, but he would come up, and I'd see him, and I'd go, hey, you know what? Next time there's a thing, and we're out of toilet paper, and I'd hit him with that. And one day he said to me, hey, Dad, I know why you do what you do, because we have limited time together. But what I'm getting is you're always trying to shove everything into that moment and a half that we have, where I would just love to, and I went,
smart kid.
I fucked up. So when you fuck up with your own kid, that's one thing, but you had hundreds of kids and hundreds of kids. That's a big responsibility. And I know you take it seriously. It's a really, really big job. And I think you did it really well, because I know how much you care. And I also know how much you're willing to say, I fucked up. Mm. You've said it in front of school. You've got up there and gone, I messed this up. And you did it as a lesson to others too. Well, yeah, but we learn from that. A lot of people won't do that.
Yeah.
It's a big thing. So thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
This is my opportunity in front of people to say thank you.
So. Well, I appreciate that. That, you know, Peter, I love you. I love you. Well, maybe that's where to end. Oh, I know I want to ask you. Is there a next on the list for Peter Tilden? Or if Peter Tilden could roll it back and have a redo, would you do the same stuff? I mean, forget your first wife, but would you do the same stuff in terms of what, you know, the
I don't think I'd have another. Yeah, you learn stuff, and it's easy to say I wouldn't do the same stuff. I've been really lucky. I mean, I'm really great. When people say grateful, and every day you get up and say you're grateful. I was born in Philadelphia, and I lived in a row home with my grandmom, and in a tiny, tough neighborhood. Like I said, what's his name? Frank Sheeran was my union rep. But still lucky, my parents then moved one block in to Montgomery County in Philadelphia. So I wasn't living in Philly County. I was living in Montgomery County and going to school with kids who were wealthy. And so I got to see a lot. And then went to Temple University and was lucky to have a mentor who was in the architecture department. And it wasn't about that. He was just a wonderful guy, introduced me to some amazing people. I've been so lucky, David. And had so many opportunities that I don't feel I should have ever gotten, because you talk imposter syndrome. That's why you didn't see me in Wikipedia. You didn't look up imposter syndrome. My picture is there. So to that, I can't even fathom going back. And I think the only way at our age, as you get older, to deal with the aging thing, because so many people I love are gone and are going, is by looking forward, by doing the next thing, and by being upset by not having guests for the show, and by what's my next challenge. Then I never look back. I don't look at old pictures much. I don't look at old stuff, because I don't want to go there. I don't want to go in the eye blink that they get us, that got us here, you know? So art, look, hanging with you, why would I trade that? Hanging, watching my kids grow up and those touchstones, why would I give that up? So no, yeah. The opportunities to do stuff. I'm just getting more tired. I don't know about you. Stuff hurts and you get tired and you have physical stuff. It's harder to get motivated to do. And this, trust me, the podcast is a bear. You know, I've got people who work with me, and you got to book it and you got to do it, whatever. But I said to everybody, I don't care about the numbers. I don't care. We're getting paid for 2 years. Let's have a good time. And let's Jason and I have a good time.
Yeah.
And I love when I can make him just go down laughing during an episode. I've hit the lottery. You know what I mean? It feels so good.
That's got to be great fun to work with a best friend.
We've been through so much together and know everything about each other together that it is wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. I miss him. Yeah. He's been in Chicago on a play for 3 months. It's horrible. Asshole. Big schmuck. Big schmuck with theater. He's got to do theater to feel fulfilled.
Well, Peter,
Tony Award winner. Tony Award winner.
Fucking Tony Award winner.
Fucking Tony
Award winner. You need another award.
Shove it up your ass. Yeah. So the next thing, I don't know. I never know. Stuff always comes out of nowhere. There's an ad campaign that a guy wants me to do now that I was joking about. So I'm meeting with them. And then I go, oi, am I really going to take this on? Because I can't help myself. I couldn't help myself with that, but not pitching in the idea. But they like the idea. So I'm meeting them tomorrow to talk about the campaign. So maybe, and that's fun. That'll be fun. It's with Jason.
Yeah.
So that'll be fun. But, and writing, just this kind of stuff is okay. If the podcast goes and grows and morphs into something, I'll be really happy.
Yeah.
And I want to spend more time doing nothing, you know, playing music or just.
There's that.
Just sitting around.
There's that.
Yeah. Because the real things I want to do, my family won't do. I want to get a boat and live in a marina. No one will do that. So there you go.
Yeah.
So I'll live a bitter with gratitude and bitterness. Yeah.
It's a life of I lived on a boat for 4 years. And so.
But you love being on a boat, right?
I loved being on the boat. I love being on the boat. It's 4 years of being uncomfortable.
You're never.
That's the other
really
thing. Everything begins to rot as soon as you're on the boat.
Never,
everything is rotting.
The ceiling's too low. It's never enough.
It's wet.
It's just there's that.
There's that. But
sitting in the marina. That is the delightful.
See, that
experience.
For me is coming up, having a cup of coffee, sitting on the bow of the boat, and looking out at the sunset in the marina, and you're on the water.
It's the most luxurious thing in the world. Right there, and
watching a boat rot underneath you.
And when you're tired at the end of the day, you know, you look. There's no place to be more comfortable. There's no bed that is more comfortable than when you get to lie down.
I don't know if you remember. For a short period of time before I got married, I lived in a box. It was just a tiny tinder box, right on PCH, where it was on still. It was in the water basically. The water went under the thing. My patio was, and it was one room basically. They had divided into a living room. Living room, kitchen, bedroom, bathroom. But I'm talking tiny as could be. And people were like, how small? It was 600, 800 square feet. But my one wall was the entire.
That's room. Exactly. My backyard.
And it was the
it's
most
really
amazing.
Big.
That was the most amazing 2 years.
Yeah.
Going to sleep with that noise. It was loud.
Oh, yeah.
I
love it when people say, I love being out in nature. It's so quiet. Really?
Really?
You've never been in nature, obviously.
Oh, nature's loud. This was insanely loud, but I got to see whales, and I got to see, you see patterns, and you know when the dolphins are going to come because you can see the birds are starting to feed, and the pelicans are feeding, and I saw Great White and Gary Busey, who used to live below me. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was fascinating.
It's way scarier than a Great White.
Oh, trust me. Trust me. If he had something to tell me at 3 a.m, it didn't matter that it was 3 a.m.
Right. Yeah.
He had no circadian rhythm, I don't think, at all whatsoever. So have I talked too much? Has this been boring? Peter, or is there anything else?
No, the Peter Tilden. I just love hanging out with you, and I wish
and
we were
vice versa. I'm glad that we were
in a similar place that we could
do. Why did you move to Wyoming? What the hell is that about?
Well, we moved away from Northern California because the fires chased us.
Yeah.
And Shelley, who is my wife, is way smarter than I am, said, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to feel settled here anymore. Because it was terrifying. We were evacuated for over a month. The fire was burning for a month. And it's still, 8 months, 9 months, 10 months later, I was getting, emails. They were still, they dug in, dug into the ground and they found roots burning. It was still, I mean, it's still.
It's frightening. It's frightening.
And wait, but the snow globes, are they still there?
What's funny is I have probably 12 or 1400 snow globes and started by going with my friend Howard, you know, how my friend Howard Klein, who you know from the school, because his kids.
Yeah.
We would go on Sundays to flea markets just to get out of the house. And we loved getting up at 6 and going to flea markets, walking around. It was great exercise. It was fun hanging out with your friend. And he would collect stuff because he had a business and money. And I'm on radio and I don't have money. So I started doing snow globes because I just liked the way they looked.
Yeah.
There's something magical about like this, you know, like I love the business ones because they were on somebody's desk at some point. But, you know, like that. There's just something really cool about an old snow globe. Okay. So I started collecting them. And then once it got out on radio and other places, goodbye money, goodbye shirts, goodbye anything else. It was like, really? More snow globes. And they're cheap. So I'd go to the flea market and the woman would say, I saved you a box. There's 80 in here for $15, you know, that kind of stuff. So last year I wanted to purge a lot of stuff. And I said to my son who lives downstairs with the snow globes, I said, hey, Rob, I'm thinking about getting rid of them. And because for years he was like, ugh, this is, you know, do I have to keep these up, whatever? And he went,
no.
Yeah, he loves them. So
totally.
Oh, I can't believe I can't remember his name. Corbin Burnson. Corbin Burnson, when I would go to these out-of-the-way places to find a snow globe, Corbin was already there. And all the flea markets, I think he has thousands and thousands. He started manufacturing them. He loved them. Corbin is the world champion in snow globe. Trust me.
Cool.
And we would walk in, like I walk in North Hollywood on a Sunday morning at 6:30 to like a lodge where they were setting up. And there's Corbin. He looks at us and looks at me and goes, there's something wrong with us, right? There's something wrong with us. But there's something aesthetic about this.
Oh, they're fabulous.
This is James Cameron's partner. James Cameron's partner. This was his New Year's snow globe, you know, that kind of stuff. And then I did a show with Jason Alexander called Hit the Road, and Jason is a gift to everybody, cast and crew. When it was done, gave him Hit the Road snow. So that, look at that. I mean,
it's great.
There's some of them, yeah, there's some about it.
They're great. And some of them are incredible. I mean, some of them are incredible.
There's some downstairs that are European that artists designed that are stunning, 3D that are pretty amazing.
Wild.
I'm trying to think.
Absolutely.
If there's any other that I have here that's not? Nah. I mean, that's. I have some here, but most of them are downstairs. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I love you, Peter Tilden.
Love you too, David.
Next time I'm in LA, I'll let you know where I'm coming.
Please. I would love to love to see you. The kids would love to see you, Tommy.
Totally.
I'd love to see you. And you're special. You're a special big part of my life. Big part of my life. I don't think you'll ever know how big a part of my life you were and the impact you made on both my kids and my wife and everybody around you. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.